You're listening to Trek FM.
Taking all these books?
I thought I'd take some light reading, in case I got bored.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Literary Treks. I'm Christopher Jones, and as always, I have with me here Matthew Rushing. Hello, Matthew.
Hey, Chris. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. You know, we're recording just a few days after Christmas here and had a nice holiday break. How about you?
Really nice. Got 4 days off in a row, so that was really great.
Nice.
Got a chance to just have a really slow holiday. You know, not too much happened, just a lot of time off, friends and family. And so that was really great. I really appreciated that.
That sounds nice. 4 days off in a row is rare.
And it is.
Something to, you can really get into something that you want to do for a change instead of feeling rushed about it.
Yeah, we really got a chance to just hang out. I had some friends come in from New York and Denver, and our close family friends got to hang out with them on Christmas Eve, go to family's house on Christmas morning and during the afternoon. And then during the afternoon here in Dallas, it actually snowed, which was quite shocking.
Oh, wow.
It doesn't happen all that much. But so we actually had a white Christmas here in Dallas. So it was really nice to be able to sit down to the family meal and have the, you know, the blinds open, and outside it's just become a winter wonderland. So
that sounds nice. Yeah, no snow in Tokyo. We don't get snow very often anymore these days. We used to get a bit more in years past, but you know, Dallas, you guys have that weird weather there, right? It's like, it doesn't snow that often, but it snows at inopportune times, like during the Super Bowl a few years ago.
Yes.
Right? Where the transportation was just thrown into chaos because a snowstorm hit.
Yeah. Well, and it's one of those things is we have all the huge overpasses that are really high up in the air, so they freeze very easily. And so anytime it gets really bad, it really does shut the city down. And luckily, it's been so warm here, honestly, that it didn't last that long on the ground, on the streets. And so, you know, most people were fine.
Well, that's why we need shuttlecraft, so we can just fly around, that we don't have to worry about anything freezing.
Exactly. Or just, can please somebody invent a transporter? That way, you know, the Trek FM family can actually go all the way down to Wellington and visit the wonderful new Green Dragon pub, and we can all pretend to be hobbits.
That sounds like a plan. We really should do that.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
All right. While they're there, we can sit around, we can have our drinks, and we can talk about news. And we're going to start off today, and we're going to talk about book news. And for those who, you know, there are a lot of series out these days, the Typhon Pack series, the Destiny series. Sometimes it's hard to keep up with each book as they come out, but it looks like, Matthew, here, that there's a solution for that problem coming up for everyone.
Definitely is. They are going to be releasing 3 ebook omnibuses, and they're going to be wrapped around 3 different series that have been out. So the Typhon Pack, they're calling it the Kittimer Cord Saga. And that's going to be comprised of the 3 most recent Typhon Pack books, David R. George's Plagues of Night and Raise the Dawn, along with Una McCormick's Brinkmanship, which we're just about to talk to Una tonight, so I'm really excited about that. So her book will be available in this series. Then they created this original series. And they called it The Continuing Missions, Volume 1. This year it's got The Rings of Time by Greg Cox that had come out, That Which Divides by Dayton Ward, and then Christopher Bennett's second Department of Temporal Investigations novel, Forgotten History, which was fantastic. So that's definitely going to be a wonderful series to collect. And then the Destiny Saga. Have you read the Destiny Saga, Chris?
I haven't read all of it. I've read a little bit. This is with Captain Ezri Dax, and the Aventine is part of that saga, right?
Yes, it is. Which I really, you know, I'm rereading that series, and I really love Ezri Dax as a captain. She really comes into her own. Of course, this is the huge series that changed everything in Trek literature, with the Borg finally been brought to an end. Spoiler alert. That was a little late there. And
a late spoiler exactly. alert.
And also brought in the Titan. So the three captains there, Riker, Ezri, and Picard, dealing with the Borg in different ways. And so this is the series, you know, if you haven't read Star Trek books in a while and you want to be in the 24th century world, this would, I think, be a great place to start. So I'm really glad that they are collecting this series all together as an ebook series. And hopefully these will all be kind of a, you know, one shot lower price.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I tend to buy the standalone novels. I do have the DS9 reboot, the first, was it the first three books, I believe, that they did an omnibus?
Yes,
Of those with Avatar, yeah. Yeah, so it's kind of nice. Of course, these days I prefer to get digital. I have the DS9 omnibus, I have it in paperback, and it's really huge.
Yeah, it is huge. And they had
Not fun for carrying around on the train in Japan.
No, not at all. And they had released the Destiny series as an omnibus in paperback form. And again, like you said, you know, it looked like a doorstop. And so this does really give you that functionality. And great, you know, having three awesome books at a low price, you know, on your e-reader, available anytime, it is the way to go. These are going to be out in January. I'm definitely going to be picking up... I think the Destiny series one for sure. I have all the rest of these, and the Destiny series is ones that I had on loan, so I'll be picking that up and be really excited to finally have that digitally, because I have them in paperback and I just don't enjoy reading in paperbacks. So
yeah. So this is great, and you know, you mentioned the Department of Temporal Investigations. That's a series I really like, because I think sometimes on the shows, time travel is not always handled well, but I love the concept of time. And I think it's great that Christopher Bennett is doing this DTI series.
Well, and he does such a really good job of connecting all the different time travel stories and making them seem as if there's some rhyme or reason to them, that, you know, they're just not random occurrences. And the way he weaves all that together is masterful. And so if you haven't read this series, you know, pick up those two books themselves, because those are fantastic books. And they're really something, as a fan, you can just kind of jump into those two. You don't have to have read anything else. And so that's really great, you know, because it's based off the two characters from Trials and Tribulations, which, you know, who would have thought that those two guys would have been someone I'd want to read about? But if he keeps writing this series, which I do hope he'll write more in later on, I'll continue to read them, because I'm always having a good time.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. So many of the books now, you need to have read other books in order to go to the next book. But these DTI books are something that you can just pick them up and just read them standalone. Especially if you're familiar with the TV series, all the shows, all the time travel episodes. You don't have to, like we were just talking about Destiny, which changed things so much. You don't have to have all that background knowledge in order to enjoy these books.
Well, that's true. And it's one of the things about this year that they are going to have a lot of TOS books come out. And definitely will be books that you probably won't have to have had read everything for. You know, it's usually 5-year mission stuff, easy to jump in and just enjoy. And so I do like that. And of course, you know, with Into Darkness coming, that's probably the main reason.
Yeah. All right. So watch for those. They will be coming out in January. Okay. So let's go on to comics. Now, we just have a little bit of book news this week. We're going to talk a fair bit about comics. We're going to talk about December compendiums. Now, of course, we're already at the end of December. A lot of the IDW stuff has been delayed because of the port strike, which we talked about last show. But Matthew, what do we have coming up here in terms of compendiums?
Well, the first one was the omnibus that gathers together four TNG graphic novels, The Space Between, Intelligent Gathering, The Last Generation, and Ghosts into one mega book. And so this will be really cool. I love when they do this. It gives us a chance to have, for those of us who haven't been collecting Star Trek comics for a long time, to have all of these comics in one instead of having to go and try and find them, you know, individually, or, you know, find their collected paperback versions. These give us a really nice, unique collections. And so this first one, I think, is great. You know, the TNG is really big still right now with the HD releases on Blu-ray. And so I think this will be something that fans will really enjoy.
How do you feel about that? Now, for comics that are older and maybe there aren't digital versions, I love these compendiums because I can then get those comics onto my iPad. But just generally speaking, if you have the ability to buy standalones, digital, or wait and get them as a compendium, what do you prefer? Do you prefer, because I personally prefer to have each individual comic or each individual book or each individual movie sometimes as well myself. I don't know why. I think it's kind of like the collector in me feels that way, but how do you feel?
You know, I have, even digitally, the first two ongoing volumes. And then the rest of them are just singles, as we've been kind of keeping up and doing this show and talking about them. I've needed to read them, and so I haven't been able to wait. I actually, on the other side, I actually prefer the collections because it's just less space. And that was really especially on the shelf. You know, now that it's digital, it's not as big a deal for me to just have the one-off issues. It doesn't really bother me at all because it's all the same, really. But I do like, you know, when they take these old comics that might not necessarily be available digitally yet and do put them all together in a really nice, you know, paperback or hardcover form as comics. You know, that's great for collectors. And I know that there's tons of Star Trek comic collectors out there who would really like to have this. And so I think these are going to be great. This compendium is going to be 480 pages. It's $29.99, which I'm sure, you know, on Amazon you could probably find for less. Barnes & Noble, those kind of places, be selling it for less. But yeah, I think this is going to be something that's going to be big for those fans who just, you know, we haven't gotten a chance to get these yet, or maybe we haven't even seen them yet. And with, you know, the hype around The Next Generation specifically right now, I think this is a good time for IDW to strike.
Yeah, definitely. Now, the other thing that's coming out here, this we talked about this last week a little bit, I believe, or the week before, the newspaper strips by Thomas Warkentin. And, well, there's several people involved, him, Sharman DeVono, Ron Harris. These are those newspaper strips from the late 70s and the early 80s, which I think a lot of people missed. I don't personally remember them because I think they were not in the newspaper in Birmingham, where I grew up. And so this is really cool. I'm looking forward to this because for me, it'll be something completely new and a part of Star Trek history that I can finally get my hands on.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you know, obviously for me, this is before I would have been able to read. And so I'm very excited, you know, even though this is going to be something that runs $50. This is definitely something that I'm really seriously thinking about picking up. Like you, I think this would be something great to have on the shelf. You know, I feel like this will work better in print maybe than it would digitally anyway. It'll just look great in print. Yeah. And it really, you know, honestly, having a newspaper strip is really made to be on a page and not necessarily, you know, a screen. And so I think that this is going to be something that fans are really going to like. And like you said, this is something that hasn't been seen in a really long time. And a lot of fans just getting into Star Trek, you know, with JJ's Star Trek and everything, they're looking for stuff to get into. And I think this will be fun to kind of see In the same way the Marvel Star Wars universe is still around and still people enjoy reading those funny comics then, I think that the same way people are going to really enjoy getting back into these old Star Trek comics that were in the newspaper.
Yeah, that is going to be cool. Now, this is the first volume, which is going to include the first 10 story arcs, starting with the strip that debuted on December 2nd, 1979, and running through October 25th, 1981. And this is going to cost $49.99, as we said, so it's a little bit pricey. I imagine somewhere like Amazon, you'll probably be able to buy this for like $29, $30-something dollars, probably. They usually discount these things quite a lot. It kind of reminds me of, I've been buying these for the past few years for my wife because she really loves the old Peanuts strips. They've been doing hardcover books of all the Peanuts strips.
Yes, they have. I have a couple of those.
Yeah, they run, I don't know, maybe, how much are they? Like $39 or so?
I think they're $29.99 or $30.
Yeah, and there are a lot of them. Yeah, I think we have like 5 or 6 of them. I don't know how many there are altogether, but there are quite a lot of them because Charles Schulz wrote Peanut strips for so many years. So again, I don't know how many volumes there are going to be here total, but this is going to, you know, set you back a little bit if you want them. But again, it's going to be a great collector's item, so I am looking forward to that.
I do believe this is going to be in hardcover, and so I think that's one mm-hmm. of the reasons for the cost being a little bit more.
Right.
But I think, like you said, just like those Peanuts collections, I mean, those are well worth the money. I have the first two. Mm-hmm. I love them. I think they're great. The display is awesome for them. So I can't see. And, you know, once you get your hands on this, you're definitely not going to feel like you're wasting your money at all. This is going to be something for the diehard fan in your life.
Yeah, most definitely. So next up, we have the Countdown to Darkness covers. Now, we've seen a few, I guess we've seen 3 of the 4 covers now. There's the Uhura cover, which I believe was that the first one that was ever shown, was the Uhura cover?
That is the first one that they did show us, I think.
That's what I thought.
And then they
yeah.
kind of went back and showed us the Kirk cover. Now we've seen the Spock cover. And so our friend mm-hmm. over at 805, I use his site all the time, great guy. But he gave us kind of a mock-up of what we thought the final cover might look like. And he's basing this off of, you know, with Countdown last time, Nero was the last comic cover because he was the villain. So he's put John Harrison as the last cover, which I'm hoping that he's right because we definitely, I think, need a background for John Harrison. If they give us some kind of, you know, if this guy's supposed to come from somehow inside Starfleet, you know, to detonate all that it stands for, I'd really like a little bit of backstory with him, I think.
Well, you know, as Landru, our TOS editor, Drew Stewart, pointed out on the Observation Lounge, the actual canon villain is Dr. Carol Marcus. Because
yes, I heard
she's canon and Harrison's not canon, and they said that the villain is a canon character. So it's we're wondering why Dr. Marcus is there. Well, now you know.
I'm wondering then why she would be screaming in the trailer. And maybe it's because she was having a bad hair day, she thought, and just
could be,
you know, saw that in the mirror and blood-curdling scream is the only answer.
Probably.
So
she's like, I cannot carry out my evil scheme with hair like this.
Terrible, terrible. Hopefully they have a good barber like Picard had on Enterprise, and so she can get that fixed.
Yeah, they'll have Mutt. I'm sure Mutt's there.
Yeah, that would be great. Well, yeah. I mean, he's like Boothby. He's been around forever. He's seen everyone.
Exactly.
So.
He's the immortal Bolian barber. All right. So, but I think that there's a good chance that Harrison would be the fourth cover. I think part of the point of doing this comic is, of course, to lead us into the movie, and we're gonna need some background. I think it's one of those things where if you go into the movie and you don't know anything about Harrison, you'll be fine. The movie will make perfect sense mm-hmm. to you and you'll enjoy the movie. But for those of us who want to know a little bit more, this comic is the way that they can give us that backstory about him. So when we go into the movie, we know a little bit more about why he's doing what he's doing.
Yeah, definitely. Well, and it looks like, too, it might be something that would help link us with what's being talked about with Pike and Kirk. You know, Pike talking about how he admires Kirk, but he's not quite sure whether Kirk's going to get everybody killed because he's so arrogant. I feel like maybe we might see that mission in this comic that that Pike is talking about. So, yeah, I really am looking forward to this comic. I think that this is going to far exceed Countdown. That's just my guess, which I'm hoping it will.
Let's see, what else do we have? Ongoing number 16 is going to be out finally on January 2nd, they say.
Which I'm really excited for. I was hoping it was going to be out today. I actually contacted Comixology's support department today. Asked them when that was to be released. They said that it is scheduled to be the 2nd. As we said, you know, a lot of IDW's comics got pushed back. And so I'm really excited that this will finally be out. I've wanted to see what's going to happen, this Mirror Universe series. And so this will be the, you know, the end to this Mirror Universe duology. So I'm really not sure what to expect.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that too. And for those wondering when we're going to actually go into an in-depth feature discussion about comics on this show, we are planning to do that sometime over the next couple of shows. We've been waiting for this comic to come out, and then we're going to take on all of the ongoing comics that are retellings or loosely associated with original series episodes and kind of talk about how that series has evolved and how it has helped to branch the Abramsverse off from the prime timeline. So that's going to be a fun discussion.
Yeah, I think it will be. You know, mostly I found the comics to be a lot of fun. I've really enjoyed ongoing so far. I think on a whole, it's been a very positive experience and really showing off what IDW can do with Star Trek. And so I'm very excited to get to talk about that in a few weeks.
So the next thing that we'll talk about, and I guess the last thing we'll talk about in our news segment today before we jump into the feature and you talk to Una, are two December releases. The first one is the Star Trek 100-page Winter Spectacular, which I believe is not available digitally, correct? This is something we have to go pick up in paper?
It is not available digitally yet. If you were to look on your Comixology app or the Star Trek Comics app, you'll see the summer 100-page spectacular is available digitally. So this will be coming out sometime. I emailed them and asked them, and it's somewhere in between the same-day release and not same-day release, honestly. They weren't sure where that's going to fall in. So I'm sure will come out digitally, but if you get a chance, go to your comic store, pick this up. It is 100 pages. It's $7.99. It's fantastic. Been reading it right now. I love it. The first story is about Captain Harriman and Bones, just right after the end of Generations and dealing with the fallout of losing Kirk and the impact it's having on Harriman. You know, we never got to see Bones in Generations, so the impact it's have on him losing his best friend. If this was the only one in here, it would be worth it. I liked it that much.
I never really think very much about Harriman stories, but yeah, that could be quite interesting.
Well,
do you remember back in the 90s, they did the whole Captain's Table series mm-hmm. of novels? There was a Harriman story in that series, wasn't there?
He does get his own story. They actually did a Lost series
Oh yeah, the Lost Era.
Exactly. They did the Lost Era, and Harriman has a book as well. So reading this comic, I was thinking to myself, wow, I should really go back and look for that, because I bet it would actually be really interesting, because at least in this comic, the way they wrote Harriman was really realistic, just and really down to earth. And by the end of the comic, I was thinking, wow, they could do a whole series with him, and I'd want to read, I think, continue with this crew. And so,
and at no point do they call him Stuart, right?
No, they don't call him Stuart, but they call him Bueller, which was really odd. It kind of threw me out for a second, but then I came right back. It was good.
My problem with Harriman, part of the reason I've always had trouble with him as a captain, is that for me, he's always just from Spin City.
Oh,
that's
gosh,
my
yes.
association.
Yes, yeah, you're right. I remember watching that show and thinking that same thing. Of course, obviously, yeah. I my mind does go to Ferris Bueller's Day Off. And I can't get that out of my mind, thinking that, you know, he just walked out of that movie. I mean, obviously he's older, but that's automatically why I always had kind of trouble getting into him as a character.
Well, you should write your own novel, you know, Captain Harriman's Day Off, and that'll help you kind of get that out of your system a little bit.
doesn't he already have that? I mean, he's only there on Tuesdays, so.
That's right. So he can receive deliveries.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, well, the other thing that we wanted to talk about, we've been wanting to talk about for a while, is Hive. And we've both now read Hive number 3, and now we're waiting for Hive number 4 to come out. And boy, you know, as this series evolves, it becomes more and more interesting and more unbelievable at the same time. And before we recorded the show today, I went back and I reread all three of them straight through. And I don't know. What do you think about Hive, Matthew?
I like it. And yet, it is every single Star Trek trope, I feel like, thrown into one series. Especially this latest issue. You know, we've got time travel. You know, in the previous episode or issue, you had the Borg trying to join with the Federation, like it did in Voyager against Species 8472, somebody who's supposedly more powerful, except that we learned that this was actually just all a ruse by the Borg. So I thought that was a nice twist, because you thought you knew it was coming, and then you didn't. So that was at least nice.
Well, did you think it was a nice twist after you got to the part, and we should just say spoiler alert here, because we're going to talk about what's in these three comics for the next few minutes. If you haven't read them, pause, go read them. It'll take you about 20 minutes to read all three of them and then listen to the rest of this. But after you found out that it was all a ruse, did you still think it was a good twist? Because my reaction to it was, okay, we've already done this before. It's Species 8472. It's you're just taking storylines from stories you've written in the past, and you're just reusing them at this point.
That's partially my reaction. The other part is that, okay, you might trust the Borg at this point in the story, because yes, they have come up against species before that they couldn't beat. And so they might be telling the truth here. And you would think they'd be telling the truth, because you know from Voyager's history that this is possible. But I think you're right in the sense that, yeah, we have seen this before. And I think that reading this, I keep kind of comparing it to Destiny and what David Mack did in that series with the Borg. And running up against that, I'm finding this part just lacking. I mean, it's fun to me to see kind of what, you know, Brannon might have created for the end of the Borg in his mind. But I keep running up against that to me. And I've seen, I feel like, the end of the Borg done better.
Yeah. This, for me, well, you've got who I call India Married Borg Queen here, because she's got this gigantic red gem on her forehead. I guess that's, she married to Locutus because he's the king and she's the queen, or I don't know what's going on there. For me, it feels like, You said it's fun. I think that maybe that's a good way to describe it. It is kind of fun to read it, but at the same time, and maybe because it was being written by Brendan Braga, who wrote the show, I kind of expect things to be a little bit more rooted in Star Trek as opposed to just this kind of superhero type feel. I feel like Data and Picard here are like superheroes.
Yeah.
And the Borg Queen is like the arch, the nemesis. And it just doesn't feel like a Star Trek story to me. It feels like, it's almost like comic form JJ movie to me in a way. Do you know what I mean?
It's very, you know, it's very big and expansive and grandiose.
Yeah.
And its scope and its, and in just even the visuals of the comic. And so it definitely feels more like a JJ verse. But, you know, I think one of the things that it feels like to me when William Shatner wrote his books, you know, Ashes of Eden and The Return and then all of his others. And people kind of like made fun of him for bringing back Kirk and, you know, Kirk being the hero and everything like that. And Kirk was just basically this action figure in those books. You know, he got made fun of for that. And that's what ran through my mind when you were talking about Data and Picard just kind of being these action heroes and comic book heroes, basically. That's a little bit what Hive feels like to me. Is that, you know, we're trying to go back and just relive the glory days, except I might not be enjoying this as much as I did Shatner's books.
I think for me in the series, the first two issues, I felt like, oh, this is kind of interesting. Let's see where it's going to go. And then the third one here kind of jumped the shark for me a little bit. It's so, you know, of course, someone has to go over and fight. And so that's, of course, going to be Worf who goes over to the Valdrenae ship to fight them. You've got the, we talked about earlier how Worf would always just kind of show up in the Next Generation films.
Yes.
At least here, Riker just shows up as well, but at least the Titan is in the battle.
Exactly.
There's a reason for him to be there.
Yeah.
And we wish that in First Contact, Riker had already been captain of the Titan. He had already moved on, had his own ship. The Titan was part of the battle, just like the Defiant was, and he had to come aboard the Enterprise, and we could get the whole crew back together that way. And the reason is that it just felt like the characters should have moved on with their lives sooner. Because it just drags on and on and on.
Well, and you know, I can really agree with that. You know, the Next Generation characters, because they got 7 years on the show, feel stifled by the time they get to the movies. Whereas the TOS characters only have 3 seasons. And so once you get to the movies, you know, it makes sense for them. You want to see them together longer. And so, yeah, you really do run into this. And, you know, some of the things in this comic kind of follow the novel verse chronology. You know, Titan looks like the Titan from the novels. You know, Riker having his own ship. You know, it looks like Christine Vale is his XO there. Those kind of things. But then, you know, other things don't follow that timeline, like, you know, obviously how they're using Seven, the fact that Picard and Crusher are not in a relationship. Was I was really disappointed in that this series actually started out with Picard and Vash, of all people, one of the worst characters in Star Trek, if you ask me. I hated her character with Picard because, you know, she just doesn't fit with him. Like, I mean, and I guess that's the point, you know, the opposites attract kind of thing, but yeah, for the long run, this is not going to be the guy. I never picture Picard being the, I'm going to make an intergalactic booty call. So Vash, come running because I got needs. You know, I just don't feel like that's Picard. So I was really disappointed to see that, you know. So this comic is leaving me, okay, it's all going to be about the end. And I'm getting the feeling that we're about to hit the big fancy red Voyager reset button. Because
oh, yeah, of course.
Data, you know, comes back to the last page is, you know, Data between universes from 500 years ago to now.
Yeah.
And I just really feel like, okay, you know, Data was lost in Nemesis. This is kind of Braga's way of giving Data back to them without having, you know, basically bringing Data back to life through B4, just kind of ignoring that. And I don't know. Mm-hmm. I just feel the reset button coming, and I think that's, I don't know. What do you think, Chris?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that's where it's heading. And I think that's what Greg told me the same thing after he read it too. He actually said, I'm hating this comic. and he wasn't like that until reading number three, but I think it's basically the same reasoning that you say that it feels like, yeah, we're heading towards that reset button. And,
well, this is one of those areas where I really wish, you know, maybe Brandon will come on and let us know, you know, just kind of his thought process. I'd love to talk to him about this and just kind of pick his brain, you know, why did you do this? You know, what made you use Seven like this? And because Seven seems really much more like she was at the beginning of Voyager when she first came on, you know, season right. 4 or 5, and then she does the character that she evolved into. So I was very surprised to see that, you know. I'd love to, you know, kind of understand his creative process here, because, you know, I know Brandon, and he's written some great episodes for Star Trek. And, you know, some of his episodes have been some of the best we've had. And so I just love to see what he thought, you know, in doing this.
Yeah, it would be interesting. Yeah, what is the thought process? And I mean, to be honest, I don't mind. It's a comic. You can do whatever you want to do in the comic. And even if they hit a reset button here, it doesn't actually affect the Star Trek universe
as
we know it, because this is a self-contained comic story.
Did you
notice?
It's
just the idea that things always end up that way, which becomes kind of frustrating.
Yeah. Did you notice on page 18 here, is that the Nexus?
That's exactly what I said. Yes, that's what I said. I was reading it, and I got to that frame, and I went, "Oh, geez, is that the Nexus?" That's what I said to myself as I'm reading, and It doesn't actually say. I mean, in here, you can't. But so they're looking at the view screen, and you see it, and Riker says, "Captain," and then on the next page, mm-hmm. Picard says, "It can't be." And then you jump 500 years into the future.
And then the next
scene... So I don't know for sure.
In the next scene, you come back. It's the very last page of the comic. On the view screen behind Picard, it looks like the Nexus has passed over them. And Data is standing between worlds. Between 500 years in the future and, you know, now. Or now, in quotes. You can't see it because it's a podcast, but in quotes. And so...
That's right.
I have a feeling that, and somehow this is the Nexus, and that Brandon's going to use the Nexus, in the storytelling, of, you know, how this all gets fixed, which, you know, I mean, the Nexus has only been used once. And so, I'm not opposed to seeing it used. But at this point too, you can also make up any rule you want for it, because we honestly don't know how it works.
But the thing about it being the Nexus, and it does look like the Nexus, and I think you're probably right, but on page 21, when half of Locutus Picard is lying on the floor, and he tells Data, the chamber just beyond the Queen's alcove, it's a temporal displacement hub. So is he saying that the Borg Queen, like, kind of has the Nexus on the other side of her alcove, or can control the Nexus? Or, I mean, is he tying the Nexus and the Borg together?
That's somehow? I was wondering that, or if they had found a way to control the Nexus, you know, to be able to call it or move it the way that, you know, temporal displacement hub, you know, that's techno babble. It can be anything you want. But I think maybe it might be some way of controlling the Nexus, but you know,
right.
We'll have to wait for 4 to come out to actually find out exactly what Brandon has in mind for the end of the Borg.
Right, because, you know, that's what I call my DVR remote control. It's a temporal displacement hub. I can record shows when they're on, and I can watch them later.
That's true. And I love being able to displace time like that. It's wonderful. I actually feel that way when I talk to you, because I'm displacing time, because I'm actually talking into the future. And so, you know, my words have to kind of elongate and then, you know, go through the subspace tunnel.
And they stretch as they come here.
Exactly.
Well, hey, what can I say? You know, I'm future guy. Apparently I am Captain Archer.
I want to welcome everybody to the interview portion today on Literary Treks. I'm very excited to have Una McCormick, prolific Star Trek author, recently just came out with Brinkmanship in the Typhon Pack series, and so we're very pleased to have her with us today. Una, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thanks very much, Matthew. Thanks for inviting me along.
Well, I'm so glad that you could be here. You know, just across the pond, so not too bad.
Yeah.
Of course, that means that my co-host Chris could not be with us because he's in Japan, just waking up about now.
Yes, it's probably a bit early in the morning for him.
It is. And so, but one of the things that, especially when we have authors on the first time and just kind of getting a chance to know you as an author and just a person connected with Star Trek is, you know, wanted to know what your first experience with Star Trek was. You know, what kind of made you a fan? And two, of course, for all Star Trek fans, what we always like to argue, what is your favorite series?
Oh, well, I think people can probably guess that, but that's probably not very tricky. Well, I really was a latecomer to Trek. I know lots of people watch the original series maybe as children, or they watched it growing up, but I think I just fell into a strange gap where it wasn't, because of the age I am, it wasn't on in Britain when I was growing up. So I grew up watching things like Doctor Who and Blake Seven.
Okay.
So I only came to Star Trek in the late 1980s. When The Next Generation started, and when that started turning up in the UK. So I was about 16 or 17 at the time. I was very exciting because, you know, I'd loved Doctor Who and I'd loved Blake Seven, and Blake Seven had gone off air and had been off for ages, and there was nothing to watch. It was that horrible time in the 80s with no sci-fi.
Exactly.
And then these videotapes started turning up at, you know, my local video rental shop, and every couple of Fridays I would bunk off from school a little bit early and go and hire one of these tapes with two episodes on of Star Trek The Next Generation. So that's where I started with Trek. And then some friends of mine used to get tapes in, sort of sent over from their friends in the States. So we get these little care packages of new episodes. It's like, you know, when the GIs used to, in World War, used to kind of give the Brits chocolates and stockings.
Yes,
and
yes.
Get these kind of these videotapes sent over, and they were terrible quality. You had to convert them, and we'd sit in a darkened room. It was like watching through a net curtain, and we were getting these new episodes. And I'm watching it again at the moment. It's being shown in HD in Britain.
Oh yes.
And it looks fantastic. It just looks great. And I just remember seeing it. In all this, these terrible, terrible copies that we had, but I still loved it. Just it had a magic about it, I think. Next Gen of all the shows for me gives me that sense of wonder, you know, that people talk about with science fiction, that sense of space being limitless and opportunity and new things to explore and imagine. So that's what I loved about Next Gen. But of course, it's Deep Space Nine that is my favorite. Of the Treks, because it was so complex. I think I love the plot lines. I love how those stories developed and grew. I loved being with characters that developed and grew as well. I think maybe the characters on Next Gen are quite static in
yes,
many ways.
Very much so.
They're archetypal rather than, you know, psychological, I guess. DS9 has just so many characters, not just the regulars, but, you know, the recurring characters, people like Damar or Zial and these characters. And then, of course, there's Garak. So DS9 really is, I think, the one I loved, but Next Gen has a very special place in my heart, I think. Yeah, so that was my introduction to Trek.
Oh, that's great. And I'm like you. I didn't really get into it until the Next Generation because of the age that I am. And then, you know, I actually, though, my first show was an original series episode because they used to just replay them here in the States, you know, at random times during the afternoon. And kind of fell in love with it. And then, of course, the Next Gen happened. But it wasn't really till Deep Space Nine that I got completely sold out.
Yeah, and you get hooked on that storyline, don't you? And you just want to watch more and more and more. Whereas I think with the original and with Next Gen, you can drop in and out. But DS9 just is compulsive, really, in the last few seasons, I think.
Yeah.
You've got to watch. You've got to watch, yeah.
Well, and like you mentioned, you have so many characters on Deep Space Nine that you grow to love that aren't necessarily the main characters. So, you know, you can fall in love with somebody like Garak or General Martok or, you know, any of those. And, you know, hundreds, there's 20 to 30 different characters that show up on Deep Space Nine regularly. And so any one of them, like for me, I loved when Zial showed up. I fell in love with that character.
She's a great character, really, and really well performed by all three actresses.
Exactly. And each actress brought something, I felt like, to that role that kind of made me fall in love with her more. And I didn't ever have a problem with that. You know, obviously she's a child growing up, and so she's going to change. And so, but her final actress and just her relationship with Garak is so heartbreaking, of course.
It is. It's a very good relationship. Very, really beautifully acted, really nuanced. I think they both actors do incredibly well with it.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I love Andrew Robinson. He's one of the people that I think really enjoy meeting because I think that you can just tell from his performance that he is a dynamic person in general.
Very much and so.
Well, with, you know, being a Star Trek fan and so you got into Deep Space Nine, how did you get into writing? Is that something that you always knew you wanted to do? And then on top of that, how did you get into writing for Star Trek?
Yeah, well, I think like, you know, many people who start out as, you know, if you're a bit bookish and you like reading and you like reading as a child, you always do a little bit of writing. But I wrote a little bit as a teenager, but not very much, because I was orientated towards different subjects at school rather than English. Mm-hmm. I was studying history and other subjects, I think. But when I was about 16 or 17, so when I started watching Next Gen, I got starting writing fan fiction.
Oh, okay.
And that was all based on Blake 7, which is this very dodgy 1970s, early 80s BBC science fiction show, which you may have seen.
I haven't seen it, but I do know what you're talking about. I'm going to have to look it up now.
It's kind of legendary. I always hesitate kind of recommending it to people because I love it without any kind of I've got no filters for it. But it's very stagey, very 70s, very very studio bound. So, but some people it just works. I think you just love it. And I'd watched it as a kid, and I just started writing fan fiction, got involved in fandom. So I didn't really write much fiction, really. Mm-hmm. And my ambitions were very serious. I was going to be a very serious academic. So, you know, all my writing was to do with that, really. It was nonfiction. It was articles and essays and all this kind of thing.
Well, on your nonfiction, what was your main point of interest for that? Because that's interesting to me, at least.
Well, I ended up doing a PhD in sociology.
Oh, okay.
And if you asked me now what the subject of my PhD was, I couldn't tell you. I'd struggle. I'd really, really struggle to remember. It's about 10 years ago now since I got it. So that was the route I was going down. I was interested in online communication and online communities and theories of the information society, changes brought about by computer technologies, information and computer technologies. Yeah.
Does that sociology give you like a love for then Cardassians? Is that maybe one of the reasons you?
That certainly helped. Okay. I mean, you know, the big question in sociology is the relationship between an individual and their society.
Yeah.
And that's a question that I think is is what I'm interested in looking at in the Cardassian books, definitely. Mm. Yeah, so that's the kind of writing I was doing. And then as it was turning out that I really wasn't a very good academic at all, mainly because I was spending a lot of my time writing Deep Space Nine fan fiction. putting that up on the internet and, posting it on little Usenet groups like, if people remember it, rec.arts.StarTrekCreative, posting stories up there and enjoying myself a lot more doing that than I was actually doing my research. And then one day out of the blue, I got an email from somebody called Marco Palmieri.
Yes.
And, this was a name I'd seen online. And I knew he was the editor of the Trek books at Ranger Pocket. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. I wonder why he's emailing me. He must have made a mistake. And his email was saying that he'd had my writing recommended to him and would I like to pitch to the series. So I kind of fell off my chair and then... stood up, and then I kind of ran in the other room and told my other half, I said, you won't believe this. Is this a fake? But no, it wasn't. So I pitched some story ideas to Marco, and one of those eventually became Hollow Men, which is one of my Deep Space Nine novels. Yeah. So it's Marco saved me from being a professional sociologist. That's his contribution.
That's awesome.
The good of my discipline. And then after that, I started writing, and I now teach creative writing at universities.
Excellent.
Yeah, so that's my day job now.
Man, that's...
Which I enjoy very much. Yeah, so that's all thanks to Marco. Yeah.
Yeah, he's, from what I've heard, just from the authors talking about Marco, they really did seem to love him, and so...
phenomenally talented editor, just a real eye for story, and just a great, as somebody, as a creative person, very creative himself, someone you want to collaborate with, I think, very good at bringing out ideas that you haven't articulated to yourself yet, and saying, well, try this, and you go, yes, that's exactly what I wanted to try. So a phenomenally talented editor.
And I remember watching Trek books just kind of blossom, I feel like, under his leadership, and it's that spirit, I think, has really continued to what we've gotten today. And so
I'd like to think so.
So
that's how I ended up writing. It was all an accident, and I was supposed to be doing something else, really.
It was the somebody said, the life is what happens when you're busy making other plans. I think that's John Lennon.
That's exactly right.
And so, that's exactly what happens, I think, to so many of us. We have plans, and then, fate kind of steps in and gives us something
that's
else to
it.
Do.
And you have to notice that actually you're enjoying the thing that you're doing and not enjoying the thing that you think you should be doing, and you're not doing it because you don't enjoy it.
Exactly.
You're doing this other thing. And just admit that to yourself. Yeah. So it's a great way to make a living. Great way to nearly make a living, I think.
I do enjoy your books, and especially the latest one that came out, Brinkmanship, was excellent. But I know that, and I would be remiss without talking to you about your love for Cardassians. And so I just wanted to kind of, you got to start with Hollow Man and got to explore deeper probably the best episode, I think, of the Deep Space Nine, which is In a Pale Moonlight, and kind of the fallout of that episode. And, what is it about Cardassians and even Garrick, that just really makes you so giddy?
Giddy, that's exactly the word. Very good, very good word, yeah. It was Garrick that really... perked my interest first. I think he's so richly written. I think, like we were saying, Andy Robinson is just it's an amazing performance. You're just glued to what he's doing. You just want to watch it. I can remember the moments where I thought, hang on, I've got to, is this character going to be in every week? And it's exchanges in Way of the Warrior, where he's been beaten up by the Klingons, and Bashir's going, oh, you know, you've really got beaten up, because of course Garrick gets beaten up all the time.
Right.
And Garrick goes, oh, well, you know, I got off a few cutting remarks.
Exactly.
Clearly they did a great deal of injury. I thought this is a character that I'm gonna watch. And firstly, he's a great deal of fun to write. That, you know, if you can get that dialogue right, you're just having a hoot as you're writing. It's hilarious to do. But at the same time, there's obviously this extremely dark side. And I think his story is about the extent to which someone will go to try and earn the respect and love of someone else, who in Garrick's case is his father. And my reading of the character is that he consistently acts against his own better nature and his own better judgment to prove that he's, you know, a loyal servant. And I think that tension is very productive and very, very interesting. And that's really what captured me. You know, why does he keep on doing these things? Things like torturing Odo, who's
right.
his friend, and the terrible things that he does. And you can see him not wanting to do them, and yet he will just push that little bit. Why is there no break? And really, that sort of became the question about Cardassia that interested me. That when we see individual Cardassians, people like Natima Lang or, you know, Takenigamore, Moore, we go, these are sophisticated, intelligent people. So how has their society produced them? And how does it produce people like Garrick or produce people like Ducat, who I think is monstrous?
Yeah.
What kind of civilization does those two things at once? Has these sophisticated, intelligent people and this kind of brutality and cruelty to it? And I think it's a very interesting dynamic to explore.
When you end up with, you know, like Ducat as a character who, to me, is probably the quintessential megalomaniac. You know, he has no idea the ramifications of his actions, because he only sees himself as being the good guy.
That's right, yeah.
And everybody should love him. You know, Garrick is wanting to be loved by his father and accepted by his father, but Ducat thinks that everybody should love him because he's so awesome. And why don't you see this? You know, and you see that especially in Waltz. So you have,
and people consistently act, you know, react with horror and revulsion, and he's going, "What am I doing? You know, I'm a great guy.
Exactly.
I'm so wonderful." And people are going, "No, you're monstrous."
Well, and then of course there's the great scene where Sisko finally pushes him to admit who he really is, which is, "I wish they had all died. I wish I could have killed more. I hate them all." So his true self is revealed. I think that this is what makes Deep Space Nine and the Cardassians probably one of the most amazing Star Trek races, is because they have this depth to them.
Yeah. And even with Ducat, I mean, a character that I think is monstrous, there's a genuine love for his daughter.
Yes.
Which is very, very compelling. So Zial is someone that he makes great sacrifices for and doesn't kill and takes her home, and it costs him a career and these kinds of things, and genuinely grieves for her when she dies. So even with a character who's almost like the worst product of a sort of military imperialist culture, there's a great capacity for love and a great capacity for sacrifice. And so those contradictions, I think, were very, very compelling and very interesting to me.
Yeah.
And that's what I tried to do with Neverending Sacrifice, was try and give some, look at that as deeply as I could and explore it as much as I could. Yeah. Yeah. So I do like Cardassians.
Well, and I think, again, you know, they are the race that you can do so much with, because there are so many facets to them, and they have this desire, you know, like we see in your latest book, Brinkmanship. They have this desire for structure and order in their lives, and you know, it kind of drives the agent to be drawn to the Zenkethi way of life, because she misses that so much. You know, Cardassia has been destroyed and is rebuilding itself, and is now in what she would probably consider complete chaos.
It is, I mean, when the book is set, it's not as chaotic as perhaps it had been immediately after the Dominion War, but certainly there's, in that character, I certainly thought there's a kind of hunger or longing for stability, and that part of what makes her stay is not being able to face going home again, back to that chaos and that disorder, that she wants something much simpler. And really annihilates herself in a way. So that was the idea behind her. Interesting character.
I guess we might as well go ahead and kind of jump into that a little bit, just because we're already there. Because you bring up this wonderful dichotomy between, Ezri's best friend, one of her best friends, Peter, and this Cardassian agent. And the way that they view the idea of freedom. And so for this agent, she's becoming to view freedom as that I don't have to choose. That choice is not freedom. Whereas Peter is the quintessential, American. He's the kind of character, that idea of I will pull myself up by my own bootstraps. The epitome of the West today. I must have all choices open to me or... I'm losing something of being human.
Yeah.
And so that dichotomy to me was really interesting because it also creates kind of a spiritual question as well. In a lot of religions, we have the idea of that true freedom isn't necessarily that I have all choices open to me.
That's right.
And so you the way you weaved that question into this book, I thought was masterful. And it might be missed if you're not reading carefully, but I think, learning from you that you are, what your doctorate study was, it makes complete sense why you would weave this in. And so tell me a little bit about that.
I don't really know where to start with this one, really. I think, I suppose when I was thinking about this question, that freedom for me doesn't sort of exist. It's obviously not to do with limitless choice,
right?
But in the kinds of choices that are available to any of us, and that inevitably, I mean, just because of the world we live in, that the choices any of us can make are bounded in particular ways, either by the historical period we're born in or factors to do with class or gender or ethnicity or all these kinds of things. And some people are historically more constrained. Some people today are more constrained. If you're born into poverty, you're going to have fewer choices than people who are born into a much more privileged background. That's
exactly
the nature of it. So it's less to do with number of choices, but the quality of those choices, I think. But at the same time, it's interesting you say that Peter's American, because I always forget to write American characters. I mean, he's just got a British accent in my head. But I think he does. He is saying he is responding to something that he finds quite repulsive about Zenkethi society. I think the subjugation of individual interest or the expression of individuality to a collective, and that I think he finds repulsive. But on the other hand, I think that there's no such thing as perfect freedom. There's, if it's okay to say, I think there's a kind of libertarian fantasy that one is not dependent on other people.
Right.
And that's simply not true. I think that we are all of us extremely interconnected and embedded with everyone else, and that to believe that we have, that it's possible to have this complete individual freedom is, I think, it's partly a delusion and partly denying the extent to which your liberties are dependent upon the lack of liberty of others.
So
I don't think Alden goes that far. I don't think he's a libertarian. But certainly I think he responds to something about the suppression of individuality in Zenkethi society that he finds disturbing and anathema, just completely not his culture, and that's why he responds. My backstory for Alden, which I think is subtext in the book, is that he's been an undercover agent on Absanketh himself, and so he's kind of had the same experience that you see with the Federation agent who gets killed at the end, mm-hmm. Gardner. So he's sort of gone through the same thing, and possibly gone through the same sort of process that the Cardassian Efheni goes through as well.
Right.
So it's certainly been a very disturbing experience for him to be amongst the Zenkethi, and that I think is part of the strength of his reaction. I don't know how much that comes out in the book. It's certainly my backstory for him. I don't know if that answers your question, but one of the reasons I stopped being an academic and became a novelist was so I could ask questions rather than answer them.
Well, and I think, you know, for me, honestly, when I'm reading a book, even, you know, doing these reviews now for Trek FM, and finding that the Star Trek authors are so good at putting in these large questions. Mm. And no, we might not necessarily get the answers, but that's what Star Trek has always done, is to ask us the
absolutely.
Big questions. And if we yeah. fail to ask the big questions, and I think in a lot of ways it's the detriment of, say, something like Voyager, where it doesn't ask as many large questions.
I agree, yeah.
And so, not that it's a terrible show or anything like that, but, you know, Deep Space Nine specifically loves to dive into the deepest, darkest questions that we have and try
yes.
to give us some semblance of an answer. And so,
yeah.
this question...
And Next Gen as well,
exactly.
I think it kind of,
yeah.
you know, it does the morality play, sort of
yes.
measure of a man and that kind of thing. But, yes, I think there's usually a darker spin with Deep Space Nine, but those big questions are always there, I think.
Yeah.
And I think you're right. I think that's lost in Voyager, sadly.
Yeah.
It just never finds a central moral question to be asking itself, I think.
Yeah. Well, and for me, until Kirsten started writing, I think, and her books have done that for that series. They
yeah.
have begun to really
yeah.
delve into that in the same way that all good Star Trek does. And I think she just brings
yes.
out... all of the potential that series had, and so
that the show
exactly,
No, it's a show is very lucky when it gets a writer like that. I
mm-hmm.
think who really understands it and sort of brings a questioning mind to it. I think that's
yeah.
fantastic.
Well, and I think that what's really interesting too is watching that. You know, Star Trek itself, it does have from the original series to Next Generation, Deep Space Nine. And then even in Enterprise and some of Voyager, you know, it does have a morality. It does have a right and a wrong. And there is a point to where, you know, we might respect you and your culture, but we as the Federation have our own beliefs. And Beverly in this book really it comes to grips with that whole idea of, you know, the only way that we are going to get people to see us as a power again is if we start believing in our actual way of life. If we believe
yeah.
that we are, in some ways, I feel like Sisko might probably have that, this righteousness about us that, yes, what we are, our cause is just.
And it helps to be, you know, the anointed one of the prophets. That kind
exactly.
of, you know,
it really
you
does. but I thought that was really interesting for something that Beverly, who's a character that mostly gets sidelined most of the times in The Next Generation, to really come to the forefront and be dealing with these issues of our society is so fearful right now that we are not living
yeah.
up to our best potential because we don't believe in ourselves anymore. We're backpedaling.
Yeah.
I thought that was just really another great point of there has to be something that we think is worth living for.
Yes. Yeah.
And we have to believe that it's right.
Yeah. The way I sort of thought of Beverly, I had lots of things in mind when I was writing it. Particularly, I'd seen Gates McFadden at a convention once and had really been impressed with her. She'd done a fantastic Alan Bennett monologue. She was very witty. She was very kind and generous with her fans. So it was. I really wanted to, you know, pay a little tribute to her. And you know, as you say, this sense that Beverly never really gets her moment in the sun. I thought of them almost like I was thinking. Well, let's think of them like the baby boom generation. And you know, if you'd been young and a baby boomer, so maybe 18, 19, 20 in the late 60s or the mid 60s, you must have felt limitless opportunity, I think, particularly as a woman as well, and having the feminist movement happen. It must have felt like the whole world was opening up before you. Now, I'm the generation after, I'm Generation X, and I've kind of come up, and your opportunity, you see it all implode, and you can't quite do as much as everyone else, and you can't buy as big a house, and everything's expensive. And so I wanted to convey that sort of sense of almost perhaps the disappointment that baby boom must feel looking back to its youth and going, well, it didn't quite turn out as marvelously as we expected. Because we are going through one of those troughs, I think, certainly over here in Europe and on your side of the pond as well, just like we did in the 70s, where, you feel things are in decline and there's a crisis of confidence. And I think to some extent there are things we should have a crisis of confidence about in the West, things like the normalization of torture, things like rendition. These are things that we should be concerned that have crept up and become acceptable in some way in our societies. And then there's a great deal going on in Europe that's very, very worrying. There's the rise of neo-Nazi movements in Greece and practically a collapse of civil institutions in Greece. And I think it's very important that this makes you feel that we're back in the 30s in some way, and the collapse of confidence that happened then in democratic institutions, which weren't working very well, particularly in Germany.
Yes.
But that to some extent you have to retain some kind of belief or confidence in those kinds of institutions, because otherwise what you're going to get is appalling. Mm-hmm. And I suppose that's how I was thinking about the Federation, that it's come through two very bad wars. It's had the Dominion War. It's had the stuff that happens in Destiny, the trilogy. And that this sense of crisis, people need to be saying, well, things are bad, but, my God, they can be a lot worse. And so I think it's important to keep hope or keep optimism or keep a sense of, well, these things went wrong, these things are going badly, so we've got to think about what's core to us. And I know we're in the middle of a very bad recession, things are quite bad in parts of Britain and many, many people in our society, but I do feel optimistic. I think you had a very interesting presidential election. Yeah. And I think lots and lots of people who, there's some pretty nasty demagogues who, suddenly were faced with a realization that actually most Americans didn't agree with them. And I think here in Britain as well, we had a very interesting summer where we had, the Olympics, which was like this sort of great, how grumpy British people are. And we've spent 8 years saying, the Olympics is going to be terrible, it's going to be awful, it's going to be embarrassing. One opening ceremony, we're all in floods of tears, waving the Union Jack and going, thank God for the NHS and these kinds of things. So I think this kind of, even in the bad times, you have to look and say, well, what counts and what did we get wrong? And let's go back to that and think, well, what counts to us is an open society, democratic institutions, speaking from hope and a sense of community rather than from hate and a sense of trying to set people against each other. So that was what I wanted to do with Beverly, I think. Give her that voice of disappointment, but at the same time say, well, we can't lose sight of what matters. So that was the thinking, I think.
It reminds me just a little bit of, I was reading this last year, the first biography of Teddy Roosevelt by Edmund Morris. And, for him, the idea of American exceptionalism, and not necessarily always being a good thing. I don't want anybody to hear me say that. But what I loved about that idea is that he had something very firm to believe in and a hope of what he saw America could be, and even around the world. And in the same way you were just speaking about, all of Britain being able to come together over the Olympics and find those things that they really can feel good and exceptional in. And in the same way, Beverly here having to wrestle with those issues. Okay, what is it about us that is exceptional and worthy of belief in, and what isn't?
Yes.
Yeah. And, you know, some of the...
And I think particularly at that moment in the story where she realizes that she's been used. Yes. She's been a patsy, basically. Yes. Well, why am I here? What is the point to me? And, you know, well, because there is something I do believe in. So she's having to tell herself that to make herself a little happier about her situation, yes. I think. Yeah.
And I found that just to be something that'll be, I hope, will be something that carried on in the Typhon Pact series, is to watch, hopefully, the Federation find a way to rise in a way that is with its principles. You know, Admiral Akkar being so kind of forceful with the idea of having Cardassia as part of the Federation, I believe his motives are wonderful, but I'm not sure necessarily if his methods are so kosher. But the idea that he has, okay, we want, you know, Cardassia and the Federation to be simpatico. We never want anybody to be able to think anymore that they would be at war. We want them to be as close as we are to the Vulcans, basically. Love that idea. But watching some of the machinations behind the scenes, this Machiavellian type use of people for their general benefit is, you know, what is good here and what is bad here? And is this bad intelligence work or not? And those are some great questions you ask in this book again. You know, you're asking, we have to find, and especially in this idea of this kind of Cold War we're playing, the same way, you know, the West did with the Russians. How far is too far here to protect our ideals? And
A lot of this is, I read a lot of Jean Le Carré at one point, so a lot of this is in, certainly when I reflect about this, and particularly when you're doing a kind of quasi-Cold War setting, that's exactly the questions that he's asking through his Smiley novels.
Yes.
What tools are we prepared to use to defeat our enemy, and does it turn us into our enemy? And I think these are very, you know, these are permanently interesting questions to ask.
Which, of course, you had asked, I mean, within Hollow Men, you know, with the choice that Sisko makes, the kind of the questions that Deep Space Nine asks in general with Section 31. Do the ends justify the means? You know, we wring our hands in answering that maybe sometimes they do. We're not sure.
Yeah.
Because we're not sure what that makes us in the end.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And I do love that episode. I love watching Garrick's slow corruption of Sisko. It's horrible to watch, actually. Mm-hmm. He just it's clear that Garrick knows what he's going to have to do right at the start.
Yes.
But he's got to take Sisko, you know, he's got to take Sisko down the road to hell first to get his consent. And he reels him in. It's quite disturbing to watch, actually.
Well,
and beautifully performed,
And to watch Sisko have to say that line, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And I love, know, even then, that this idea of like good, evil, heaven, hell, that we know that something is intrinsically wrong, that there is some sort of like way that we can understand, okay, this is always wrong. This is, you know, that there is an absolute. I think Star Trek Deep Space Nine really wrestles with that question because it also deals with so much gray.
Yes, it does.
But, you know, the storyline in the end is that there is an absolute good, there is an absolute evil. And we embody those in the end in the character of Sisko and then in the character of Dukat. So they play out that kind of cosmic battle.
Yeah, and at the same time you have this personal story of a character like Kira who is devout and has very clear beliefs, and who at the same time her life has been the conditions of her life, what the situation she's born into, going back to these things we were talking about earlier about choice, she's had to kill people
yes.
from a very young age. She's had to be brutal. She's had to be a terrorist, and do bad things simply in order to survive. I think she's a very, very good character, very interesting character.
Just watching through the series with my girlfriend, and she's never seen the whole of Deep Space Nine, and so Kira is actually her favorite character. Really responds to the way that Kira's been written and her storyline being probably one of the strongest in the series.
I think it is, and very well performed. I think it's just a superb.
Yes.
Well, I think the whole of DS9 is very well performed.
I completely agree. Well, one of the things that I even praised you in the review for, I loved that the female characters in Star Trek got to shine in this book. Many times it is a boys' club, and I love Star Trek, but, you know, a lot of times we get kind of the short shift with the female characters. Troy is annoying, and Seven wears a cat suit. Not that I'm complaining about that as a gentleman. In this book, I found the female characters to be the standouts. I felt like Crusher should have actually been on the cover with Ezri because she has so much more, I felt like, to do with the story in the end than even Picard. Tell me just a little bit about that and writing those female characters and what you were hoping to see happen with them.
Well, I had an idea that... Because I get quite grumpy about the lack of, seeing badly written female characters, seeing female characters sidelined, and you think, okay, well, I've got a platform. I'm getting to do a Star Trek book. Why don't I write all the point of view characters as women? Why don't I make them all female characters? So I think I was feeling quite grumpy, and I made that decision. which is, you know, good enough reason. Let's just go for it, I thought. And as it turned out, I had to bring in the character of the Cardassian, Glyn Digon.
Mm-hmm.
I had to bring him forward as a point of view character. But I think mostly we stay. Yeah, I think I've got four points of view. The other three, it's Ezri, it's Beverly, and it's the Henny, the Cardassian spy,
mm-hmm.
and Digon is the other point of view.
Yeah.
So I thought this would be an interesting experiment to push forward female characters as much as possible. And then when I realized I needed Digon, then you always choose what the story is doing rather than didactically, you know, let a kind of didactic goal drive your story. So for storytelling purposes, I needed him.
Mm-hmm.
And then on top of that, I decided to go for as much parity as possible, that whenever I needed a kind of supporting character, I would try and get complete parity between male and mm-hmm. female characters.
Yes.
So it wasn't that I was only writing women, but that there was a genuine balance. I think I did that. I think there's possibly one more named woman. And one of my supporting characters, I don't identify which gender they are, so it's a bit hazy.
Mm-hmm.
It mostly came out of grumpiness, and I thought, well, I'm just going to give it a go. I forgot how you pronounce it now. The Vinette Convention has lots of them are named after feminist science fiction writers, and there's lots of nods to people like Joanna Russ and Ursula Le Guin and Monique Wittig. So I thought I'd kind of homage them. And it's also, the society is based on a lot of kind of 70s feminist utopias and consensus decision making and that kind of thing. So I'm having a little bit of fun there. I just think it turned out okay. I think it was nice to do this experiment. I think to prove that you genuinely can foreground female characters and make it not a big deal. It wasn't that they were women, it was that they were an ambassador or a doctor or a spy or a captain. So you've got Ilka, the Ferengi.
I loved her.
You have Alizome. I was very proud of Ilka, actually.
Yeah. I hope she comes back, because she was brilliant.
Yeah, real sort of, you know, a Ferengi feminist. And think what extraordinary life someone like that would have to lead to be able to come through all that. So I was pleased with her, and I thought, well, you know, I'll just try and prove that you can do this, and that means you can write rich female characters, and that their gender doesn't matter, that you just need to write them as people. And I think it worked. I think it came off okay. Mm.
No, I definitely think that it does. And you know, on the other side, you know, Ezri is the character that I think a lot of Deep Space Nine fans were not happy to have. A lot of fans kind of complain about her character, and the fact that why couldn't we just, you know, not have another Dax? You know, to me, I've got a picture of Nicole on my wall. It's signed. I love Ezri, mainly because it was actually the perfect opportunity to explore Trill society from a whole new point of view. What is it like to be a Trill who's not necessarily ready for this? And I thought it was really smart. So for me, she completely works. And now her being a captain and trying to come into her own as a captain.
Yeah.
Tell me about one, you just in general, what your thoughts were on Ezri and writing her. And I mean, she really gets the shine in this book. So, For me, being a fan, what were your thoughts on one Ezri when she came onto the show, and then now having to write her as a captain and all that that means for that character?
Well, I really loved Ezri as well. I mean, you know, Jadzia is an amazing character, and it's a great performance by Terry Farrell. It's got such poise and such mischief. It's a really, really good character, so it's such a hard act to follow.
Yes.
And then Nicole DeBoer just comes on, and it's great. She's completely different. It's very fresh. It's very vulnerable. It's very sweet, a lot of her performance. And I really identify with Ezri because I'm quite short. I'm the youngest of six children, so it's like I've always got these elders and betters ahead of me, like my, you know, her eight lives before me. And I'm also the kind of person that will fall over my feet. So I've got none of Jadzia's poise and none of her glamour. And Ezri is completely the kind of person that I am. So I really identified with her. I think it's lovely. I think probably in the season, that season seven, perhaps they spent too much time delving into the character and trying to foreground her rather than, I think by that point, really, we just wanted to be embedded in the ongoing narrative. I understand why they did it, and I don't mind because I like the performance, but I think there were other things they could have been doing with that time. I love the episode she has with Garrick, which has many flaws as a story, but again, a really clever pair of characters to put together. So I love Ezri as a character. I understand the sort of sense of loss for Jadzia, who's also a great character. But then it was interesting to then have to go, well, now we've got someone who's much, much older, has been a host for a long time, and how she will have changed, and yet somehow to still make that feel consistently Ezri. Because I think if my sense of how you write the Trill is that you have to have a proper symbiosis. It's got to be both Dax and the current host.
Yes.
So you want something Ezri-ish to come through. And for me, that's kind of fast talking, thinking on her feet, verbalizing what she's thinking. And it was that kind of almost nervous energy that I tried to convey with her. And then it was great to kind of give her a moment where she's kind of going to her old friends, you know, sit down and shut up, mister, because, you know, I've got all this experience and all this, all this stuff to draw on that's at least as good as yours. So it was nice to give her a kind of, you know, sit down and shut up moment. So, you know, I wrote her very, very happily. I enjoy writing her. It's a good character.
She, I was just reading David Mack's second Destiny book, Mere Mortals, and getting to see her juxtaposed to Picard, and the fact that, you know, especially in that series, I felt like Ezri is Picard years ago, the ever explorer, the uber excitement for everything, and yet she does have a lot more wisdom than she would have at her age, because and that kind of old soul way that Picard always feels like he's been,
That's a really nice take on her. I like that very much.
Yeah, and I think that's what I loved about her is that she's adorable on the outside, and yet you get this feeling from her that there's always something so much deeper going on. Even if Ezri can't necessarily always figure out how to say it.
Yes, exactly.
And so I've really
And then when you get to her sort of 10 years later, she's more practiced at that, and it feels much more integrated, I think. She's got the hang of all this stuff that's going on inside her, I think. So yeah, I like that idea of her being a sort of version of Picard. That's an interesting one. I shall have to think about
Well,
that.
I'll be excited to. I'm really hoping to see. I would love almost for the Aventine to get its own series and to allow her to not just show up as kind of cameos in books, but to really take a forefront in some books. Because and I would love for you to write her because I really enjoyed the way she came off in this book.
Good, thank you very
Yeah,
much.
so.
Thank you.
The one of the things just in general with the Typhon series has been this kind of interconnected but kind of separate storyline. How was that working on? Because I know that that's a lot of information to try and keep up with as a writer. So just kind of tell me what that's like. This is a lot to take in as a writer. How does that work?
Well, part of what you're being hired for is to be up to speed. I hadn't written a Trek book in quite some time, and I was quite far behind on my reading, so I had to quite rapidly get up to speed. Partly, I was, you draw on the editor that you're working with, who is the person really who is looking after all of this and is kind of the keeper of the flame. In a way, if I'm feeling uncertain, then I try and devise a story that maybe feels a little bit more standalone, and I think possibly Brinkmanship. It could stand alone. You could read it and not necessarily feel that it was detracting from the ongoing storyline. So I like to give myself a bit of liberty to take the general situation, but to tell us almost like an episode in that main setting. So that was really what I thought with Brinkmanship. I suspect it's more of a standalone book, but I take the broad concept, this idea of a Cold War in space, and then I just came up with a very high concept idea. I just said, well, what's the most Cold War story I can think of? And that's the Cuban Missile Crisis, which was pretty much my pitch. I said, let's do that in space, and the commissioners went, yep, we're up for that, and that was pretty much where the book came from. So it is more standalone, I think.
And I liked that because the interconnectedness can sometimes get away with us, and to kind of feel like it, David Mack addressed this a little bit in his newest series, and he was I think it was either an interview I was reading of his, and he was just talking about we do try to have you want to read everything, but not have to read everything. And what I liked about Brinkmanship is that I could just jump into it, honestly. If I'd read Destiny, I could still jump into this and I would probably be okay. And the character study that you do in this book, I think, makes it so worth it as a read, because you really
Good,
are getting
thank
to
you.
see a lot of good character development for somebody that you don't like, Crusher. Poor character who Gates is a fantastic actress and deserves so much better, I feel like, than she got.
Yes, very much so.
She really had the chops, and I mean, and unfortunately, what we give her is Sub Rosa, one of probably the worst episodes ever.
In
But
7 seasons.
exactly, and she, but she. The way that she's shining here in your book, and then what David, I think, picked up in his newest Cold Equation series with her is fantastic. And then to watch her and Picard be married and really see that change their lives is excellent. And
Particularly with Picard, I think, and
that man.
it's almost like she's the experienced one, the adult in the relationship in many ways. It's she's been here before, and he's going, "Is this how it works?" And yeah, this is how it works. And
Well,
it's very good.
and then of course, in David's new book, to watch him to have to deal with, okay, I love this woman and it's changing everything about me, from the explorer that I used to be, the captain that I used to be, to the man that I am now.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
No, he's doing a great job with it. Very, very good.
So for just being the author in Star Trek, do you generally to try to keep up and read along with the series as they're coming out?
Oh, absolutely. Particularly now I've been writing for them again. I mean, I went off and did a couple of Doctor Who novels, so mm-hmm. I did fall behind in my reading then. But yes, I do keep up, because you have to.
Yeah.
You couldn't write a book and not be up to speed on what was happening. So it's part of the job in a way.
Yeah.
And I do enjoy it. So
yeah.
They're fun to read is the other thing. Yeah.
Well, one of the things that I love to ask the authors, because I always find it interesting, is for me I'm a huge reader. I read all sorts of things. If it strikes my fancy, I'll pick it up. But what is it that's beyond Trek that you enjoy? Just if you're going to peruse a bookstore, that you might pick up and find really interesting, the things that you like to read.
Well, I really do read anything. I really will read anything. And I'll limit that by saying, I'm talking about novels. When I say that, I don't read a great deal of poetry or drama, or I don't read much nonfiction either. I find it a bit heavy going. I feel like I've done my time in those salt mines. So I read a lot of novels, and I really will read anything. I'll read science fiction, okay. I'll read fantasy, I'll read crime, I'll read chick lit, children's fiction, I read fan fiction, I read literary fiction. I really will read everything. I was just flipping back through my Kindle to see what my most recent reads were. I just read a Marion Keyes, which is a chick lit novel.
Yes.
I'd read a book by an author called Liz Jensen, called The Uninvited, which is it's a really interesting science fiction novel, actually. It's kind of cross between a John Wyndham and a 70s film called Don't Look Now.
Okay.
It was a good book. I think I'll explore more by her, Liz Jensen. I'm reading some short stories by Kelly Link, and I'm reading Catherine Mansfield's journal. And then I also teach writing as well, and we... I set texts for some of my classes, and the last one I read for that was The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde by Juno Diaz.
Yes, yes.
Which I would really recommend to anyone who was a geeky child growing up in the 70s and 80s. It really is a wonderful book, and I love teaching it. My students absolutely adore it, and he's a phenomenal writer. So I'd recommend that. And then, of course, I've been reading David Mack's Cold Equations.
Yes.
And I've been reading a Blake Seven novel.
Excellent.
By a friend of mine called Scott Harrison, yeah, which just come out from Big Finish. So yeah, I really, so if it's a novel, I'll read it. So I really will. I really will. I'll read toothpaste tubes if I'm desperate.
But, yeah. Well, did you get a chance to read Casual Vacancy?
Not yet. Okay. No. One of my students is a great Rowling fan and has been pressing on it. Did you enjoy it? Have you read it?
You know, I did. I have my my own personal blog that I write reviews for, and I read Casual Vacancy, and I find it. I believe what J.K. is doing is giving us a book that is akin to To Kill a Mockingbird.
So you think that Casual Vacancy is like To Kill a Mockingbird?
because of what she's doing with the idea of race and class and poverty. I think that those are very akin to the way African Americans were treated in the South. We tend to treat the poor like that. So what she's doing in that and bringing that to the forefront and all of its disgusting grotesqueness, I think will be seen later on as being very important. I think now people are responding to it not so kindly because they don't like being shown what's so ugly about our society. And J.K. has a way of doing that. That is very poignant. She did it all through Harry, if you were paying attention, and she does it now. And so, yes, I do think that you will enjoy it. It is not an easy read. I mean, it's not, but it's, I think, an important one. And so
yeah.
I'm very
thankful. I'll certainly get around to reading it. Yeah, it's inevitable, really. Yeah.
Well, the last thing that we always like to have the authors do is one, just to share with our listeners what you're working on, what's coming up for you so that they know what to be on the lookout for, whether Trek or otherwise.
Well, I guess I suppose listeners will be interested to know that I'm doing another Trek book next year.
Yes.
Yes. And that's part of a 5-book series that's
The fall.
That's happening. The fall, indeed. So that's with David Mack and Dayton Ward and Jim Swallow and David R. George.
I love you all.
So, yeah, great. Thank you very much. Yes, so that's a very interesting project. The idea is that the story across the 5 books takes place across about, I think it takes place across about 30 or so days. So quite a lot happens, a few things change. And the idea is that although the individual books are a standalone, you get more if you follow the whole story. And you'll see quite a lot of the major players from the 24th century. Yeah.
Are you writing specifically with one crew?
I'm writing a book set on Cardassia.
Awesome.
So going back to that, and it will involve Picard and Garak.
Excellent. Ooh, that's a good pairing right there.
I know. I'm very excited. You can imagine
the verbal sparring that you could have between those two.
Yeah, exactly. Which one of them is read the most? This is the question.
Well, the Shakespearean actor against, the
other Shakespearean actor.
The Cardassian Shakespeare, whoever that was.
Shakespearean actor. That's exactly that. Yeah, I'll have to think of that, actually.
There you go. That's you. So, we needed to create the wow, that's going to be hard.
The equivalent.
Yeah. Ooh. Oh, yeah. You have a lot of work ahead of you.
I do, yeah, I do, very much so. So that's what I'm up to right now. That's keeping me busy, and will keep me busy over Christmas. So,
excellent.
You can think of me whilst you're enjoying Christmas.
I will.
Throwing bon mot around between Picard and Garak.
Well, where can our listeners follow you? What are the places that our listeners can get in touch with you and praise you for your work and ask you questions, and where are those kind of places?
Well, they're very welcome to find me on Twitter, which is I have the inspired disguise of Una McCormack.
We'll never find you now.
You'll never find me. You'll never take me alive. And you can find out what I've had for lunch and what the weather's like and where I am. And so I'm rewatching. I think I said earlier, Next Gen is being repeated in HD. So I'm watching that at the moment, and I'm usually being quite sarcastic about it, but in a very affectionate way. So if people want to read my late night tweets as I rewatch The Next Generation, they're very welcome to.
Well, there's quite a bit.
We've just had When Silence Has Loose.
There's a lot to be sarcastic about in the first season.
I couldn't even find anything to say about that. I think I was eating my dinner. So
I hope you didn't lose it.
I just managed to hang on to it. I think I was mostly looking at the wall, So I'm easily findable on Twitter, that's where I'm saying inconsequential things a lot of the time.
And you do have your own website as well, correct?
I do. I don't find time to blog these days, sadly. I think blogging's so last decade, isn't it? It's so when did we have time to blog? So
it's hard to find it, believe me.
As much as I used to.
It's
really difficult. And you feel you have to have something to say, and mostly all I've got to say is about 140 characters worth. So I don't blog as much as I used to, but occasionally something comes up and I'll post about it. And my website's just unamccormack.com, but mostly everything turns up on Twitter now.
Great. Yep. Well, Una, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a real honor and a privilege to get to talk to you, and I cannot wait to have you back for the fall. In fact, Oh man, I wish somehow we could just have a huge one where all of you get together and we can all talk about it. I don't know how that would work, but
That would be fantastic.
yeah,
That would be
we're
really, I'm sure we can do it.
yeah,
That would be,
that we might have to try and
yeah.
do that. I know Dayton would be game, and I really want to get David on here because I love his work, and his newest book is coming out next month in the TOS era, and so I'm hoping to get him on so we can talk about that. And so but
Yeah.
I really appreciate it. It's been just a joy.
I've really enjoyed it. Thanks very much for inviting me. So, thank you very much.
Well, Matthew, that was a fascinating interview with Una McCormick. I'm really sad that I wasn't able to be there with you for that interview. It's so hard for us to coordinate time zones, and with you being in Texas and me being in Japan and her being in England, it just couldn't work out. But it was great fun listening back as I did the editing.
It really was a good time. Una is fantastic. I really enjoyed speaking with her. She's written a few different books and different series, and getting to work with the Cardassians was a very interesting conversation we got to have about Garak and Dukat, and just that whole species of alien. I think it was really interesting. I really enjoyed that. And then getting to talk about her new book and brinkmanship and how that's working in the Typhon Pact and what's coming up for her. I was really excited. People should be following her on Twitter. She watches the shows back. She'll be watching, Deep Space Nine or Next Generation or something like that. She'll be tweeting to you. So, yeah, she's definitely worth a follow, and her books are fantastic. So, if you haven't ever read an Una McCormick book, go out and get Brinkmanship. If you're not up on that, get her Greater Than the Sum, which is her big, amazing Cardassian book. She also wrote the sequel to In the Pale Moonlight, called Hollow Men, dealing with Garak and Sisko and kind of the fallout of what happens in that episode. So that's another fantastic book. So definitely go and check out her work.
Definitely, yeah, great books there. Very, very good ones. All right. Well, let's tell everyone where they can find us if they'd like to share their thoughts on anything we talked about in news or your interview with Una. Just go to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there, and you can choose literary treks and send us a message. That'll come to Matthew and myself. And of course, you can post in the comments on the show page. And the show page for this episode is at trek.fm/LT4. And we'd also like to remind you to visit the overall site at trek.fm. We have 10 shows on the network covering everything from deep episode discussion to discussion of broad topics. We talk to scientists, we talk to creatives, we even talk about the work of Star Trek creatives outside of Star Trek. And Star Trek Online, if you play that game as well. There's just something for everyone on the network, so go check that out. If you go to trek.fm/pd, that will get you to the podcast directory. And if you'd also like to follow us in social media, you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm, and you can find us on Google Plus at hyperchannel/trekfmg+. And of course, you can find us on Twitter at username TrekFM. Now, Matthew, what if people want to follow you?
Well, I am, of course, all over the website there at Trek FM doing the book reviews. Got a new one coming out, Federation for 150 Years, so that'll be out soon. As well as you can find me on the Twitters. I am Matt Rushing 02. Not running for office anytime soon. Or even in the past. I'm not going to try and go back and change history. Just not interested in that. Too much work. But talk all sorts of things, movies. Of course, big fan of Man of Steel. Can't wait for that to come out. The Hobbit. Just anything you want to talk about, I'll be talking.
Excellent. And if anyone wants to find me, I'm on Twitter as well. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's Brian with a Y. And that's my name pretty much everywhere. So no matter where you go in terms of social media, you can look me up. See Brian Jones, Brian with a Y. Of course, I talk about Star Trek. I also talk a lot about Japan, college football, design. I'm a designer, all sorts of things. Music, quite a lot. So give me a follow. Well, Matthew, I guess that's about it for this week's show. I guess we should remind everyone to go to iTunes if you'd like to leave us a rating. Leave us a review. It can help our young show climb its way up through the mysterious ranking system of iTunes, so a few more people will be able to find the show.
Which would be great. I just want to thank everyone who already has done that. We really appreciate your support. It's been a blast doing this show so far, but we can't do it without you. We really appreciate listening, letting people know we're out there. So thank you for your iTunes reviews. Continue to spread the word about us so we can continue to have the authors on and bring you news about books and comics and everything else in between.
Yeah, we definitely appreciate your support and everyone listening. So until next time, enjoy your books, and we will see you on the next Literary Treks.
You call that light reading?
To each his own, number one.